This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome to Go Home in a Box, your podcast source for all things genre films from the VHS era. We traverse the dusty aisles of your mom and pop video store searching for that one treasure. You may have ignored the box that said Cannibal Women in the Avocado Jungle of Death, but we picked it up, dusted it off, and gave it a home right here at Go Home in a Box. I'm one of your grateful co-hosts, Chris Jordan. You can find me online at RetroMovieNerd.com, where this week we travel back to 1993 for a gun-slinging, machismo-oozing western named Tombstone, starring Kurt Russell and Val Kilmer.
Yes.
Yes, sir. You can find that review right now at RetroMovieNerd.com. Joining me, as always, is the runner-up for Time Magazine's Man of the Year, the Ayatollah of Pop Cultura, Joel LaPuma.
I'd thank you for that, Chris, but who the hell beat me?
Trump.
What the hell?
And he's beating everyone else. He can take you, Joe.
I need to get a Twitter account, apparently. Yeah, and you can, of course, find me at RazorCandy at RazorCandy.com. And probably this week, we're going to have up the first edition of a new series we're doing. We've been scouring used bookstores for the absolute dumbest and grodiest 80s horror paperbacks we could find.
Oh, interesting.
One of my longtime fascinations is cheap paperback cover art. And, you know, 80s horror paperbacks, 90s horror paperbacks are just an absolute goldmine for that stuff.
Yeah. You know, I spent so much time, you know, marveling over, you know, VHS box art that I hadn't thought about the paperback art.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'd say horror, sci-fi, and fantasy, all the genres have the absolute best, like, terrible and sometimes actually pretty wonderful, evocative cover art. Typically pretty cheesy, though, especially when you find a really cheesy concept. I mean, I've seen evil business suits, evil basketballs, just things you couldn't even get away with in a bad movie.
Well, you know, we looking at something similar to, like, say, you know, romance novel cover art, where you've got, like, you know, a scantily clad young woman with maybe a slasher behind her?
Yeah, sometimes. I mean, you know, some of them do have that element, but a lot of them are trying to be artsier or more impressionistic, which is always really fun, and or just trying to be more fantastic and less realistic. I always feel like the romance novel cover art, because it never really interests me, because it's always so drawn from, you know, obvious subjects in front of the artist. I mean, they're basing it on like a Fabio. Like it lends it kind of a stiffness. Like, I understand if you're reading these for some kind of, you know, fantasy value, like why you'd want that cover, but it just kind of ruins the imaginative qualities for me. Part of the reason the horror covers always work well is that it doesn't really tell you the full story, and honestly, the story you think up in your head is going to be way better than the one in the book itself.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned Fabio. I'm going to have to, I think I'm going to try and dig up a Fabio movie, you know, sometime within the next week. You know, he was at his peak in, what, the 90s, early 90s?
Oh, totally.
Yeah, I think you just rekindled some memories there of his fleeting fame, and I think I'm going to go out and see what I can dig up on Fabio.
If I recall, he had a recurring antagonistic role as himself on Big Time Rush.
Yeah, I didn't remember that.
You have my age-inappropriate obsession with Nickelodeon to thank for that, but it was actually pretty awesome. I mean, Big Time Rush, for anyone who's confused and frightened by me right now, is basically just the modern version of the old Monkey Show. It's totally worth looking into if you're feeling skeptical.
Yeah, I just dig his accent, man. I gotta.
Oh my God, yeah.
All right, well, good information, Joel. We'll be looking forward to that. Meanwhile, let's on over to the new release section here. We've got quite a few pickups this week to go through, and some of them are actually very good. And let's head down to it. Let's start in the action section here. I've got one. This one's not very well known. It's from 1988. Mill Creek has put this one out. It's called The Beast. An alternate title for it is The Beast of War. Released on DVD by Mill Creek this week. Basically, it's a Russian tank crew separated from their unit in the Afghan desert. It stars post-Lost Boys Jason Patrick. And also George DeZunza. I'm trying to think off the top of my head of George DeZunza movie, and I think the only one I can come up with is Crimson Tide.
Now, I think for him, most people would probably know him from the early seasons of Law and Order.
Oh yeah, that's a good one too. Bigger TV actor than he was in film, but
yeah.
Anyway, The Beast from Mill Creek, out on DVD this week. Getting a 40th anniversary edition Blu-ray. And it's been 40 years already. Smokey and the Bandit from 1977. I just reviewed this over at RetroMovieNerd.com just a few weeks back. Gave it a favorable review. Very positive review. It's an all-time classic, Joel.
Oh, I love Smokey and the Bandit. Huge, huge fan. You know, I think it's a film that people are skeptical about just, I don't know, because it's sort of time-locked. Like, you can't imagine a Smokey and the Bandit remake now. And also because of that very definitively Southern setting, I think a lot of movie fans are probably a little wary. I think that in a lot of people's minds, it crosses over with Dukes Hazzard, and they just see the stars in bars, and like they start cringing.
No,
which understandable.
Well,
but,
it's
like,
understandable,
I think,
but yeah, if you haven't seen it, give it a chance. It is definitely a time capsule of a bygone era. With CB radios and truckers speak, and you know the Trans Am itself that the Bandit drives, but it's just a fun movie. It's dumb, but it's fun.
Oh yeah, just likable actors just hamming it up. It's total fun.
Yeah.
Absolutely worth it.
Yeah, you've got to see Jackie Gleason as Sheriff Buford T. Justice at least once before you die. Because that is everything that people believe about the South all rolled up into one character.
It's so true.
Yeah. Moving forward, I'm not familiar with this distributor, Joel, and I'm not sure if this bodes well for the release at all, but Cheesy Movies, this is a distributor, and they put out Curse of the Crimson Altar, also known as the Crimson Cult. It's two horror icons together in the same movie. It's Boris Karloff and Christopher Lee.
Yeah, and this is one we didn't talk about, but brought up briefly a few weeks ago when we did our Lovecraft episode, because this was one of the earliest Lovecraft adaptations of Dreams of the Witch House. I've never seen it. I'm really curious about it just for that background, and of course, bringing together some horror icons to do a Lovecraft film is, you know, really promising. You know, I'm, again, like you said, the name of the distributor, and I'm not finding too much information about them. They do have a Facebook page, and it seems like they've released a lot of pornographic or semi-pornographic stuff. Looks like I'm seeing a lot of Ilsa references here.
Ilsa.
A lot of Ilsa cover art. So I'm guessing this is probably the most respectable film they've gotten their hands on so far.
Yeah.
But I mean, if you're going to release a respectable film, this is a nice sort of forgotten gem, it looks like. So, I mean, based on the film itself, I'd be willing to check out the DVD. I don't know what the DVD quality is going to be.
Yeah, because some of these some of these distributors, you know, such as Mill Creek, will they'll get prints of films and they won't really, you know, polish them up nice, you know, as in terms of the quality. So, I guess buyer beware if you want to check this one out.
Yeah, it might be a get what you pay for situation, but the movie itself like worth the price of admission. Yeah.
All right. Coming out from another distributor I'm not familiar with this week, Brink, we've got a double feature Blu-ray, Don't Look in the Basement from 1973, and Don't Look in the Basement 2, which just came out a few years ago. I'm not familiar with the sequel, Joel, but I'm quite familiar with the original from 73, having just recently seen it. It's basically sanitarium, basically being overrun by the inmates, and we've got a young innocent nurse stuck in the middle of everything. For me, this movie kind of has like a slow build to a batshit crazy insane ending, and I know that you're a fan of this movie, Joel.
Oh, definitely, and that's a perfect description. I mean, exactly an oddly formative film for me. Like, I watched it in the middle of my, you know, burgeoning interest in horror when I was really young, and it just did a lot of things that were unfamiliar to me because I was very immersed in the, you know, Friday the 13th, Nightmare on Elm Street, Halloween slasher sort of realm. So, like, that sort of trapped in the asylum plotline was new to me. The, you know, the various colorful, insane figures in the story, some of whom are sympathetic, some of whom are too far gone. Like, all of it was just doing stuff that was totally new to me. I think it's still effective even when it's stuck, their tropes you're familiar with, because just because of the grittiness of the film, how, like, the real, really sincere go-for-broke performances, I think it's really an exceptional film. Now, I know this company, Brink, is, I don't know anything about them, but Don't Look in the Basement is, as far as I can remember, public domain, so it might be them trying to release a fairly well-regarded cult film that was not expensive to pick up.
Yeah, that makes sense. Don't Look in the Basement 2 is probably really what they're trying to sell, you know, with this release. And having not seen it, I'm assuming it just doesn't hold up to the original, because let's face it, not many efforts do in terms of, you know, taking an original idea and making a sequel or a reboot or whatever from it. But, it's definitely a curiosity since, you know, the first film was just so enjoyable.
Yeah, and, you know, partly because of the gap of time between the two films, I'd be curious to see what they're doing to justify the sequel or to work off the original film. It's an interesting idea. I'd have to give them credit for that.
Yeah. Speaking of interesting, MVD Visual is putting out a couple of, forgotten or lost films this week. First from 1983, it's a French horror gore fest, pretty rare to find. It was shot on Super 8mm, called Mad Mutilator, or Ograph, the Mad Mutilator. And, yeah, I'm not too familiar. I have not seen this. Of course it is rare. I'm not sure how many people have actually seen it, but this is one that I think its reputation precedes itself.
Yeah, it's a name that gets bandied about as sort of almost like street cred in among serious horror fans. Like, oh, I've seen Ograph. This is one I've never gotten the chance to actually watch, but it has sort of a very sort of ultra gory, ultra low budget, grody. Even for the most part, shot on video kind of horror. I mean, the fact that it's 8mm is really interesting to me. I've been waiting to see this for a while. It's supposed to be like basically totally Z grade, like pretty much plotless, very largely dialogue free, and completely surreal.
Oh. Yeah, surrealism in film. That's something that I don't want to get off on a rant or a tangent a little bit, but to sum it up, surrealism is not something I pick up on too well.
I think this is more surreal just because of the nature of how they're filming it, and not because of it. It's not like, I don't know, like Black Moon or something, where they're going out of their way to present you with like surreal effects in order to tell a story. I think it's just surreal because it's so weird and outside the bounds of normal cinema.
Okay, so that's what you're shooting for. Yeah, I think.
We're not
talking like Eraserhead here. We're just talking balls to the wall, just crazy shit.
Yeah, we're not talking like existentialist cinema, art house cinema. I mean, just like they have no budget, they have no idea how to construct a movie, so it's weird just because what seems natural to them is not close to what we view like a normal film to do.
Right. And then they're following that up, MVD Visual, with a movie from 1991 called Science Crazed. I know all I know about this film. I was checking it out, and there's a quote on Amazon that calls it the Holy Grail of Canadian cult cinema. And I guess with that trumped up, you know, hyperbole, I guess it's something that we're going to have to check out. I know nothing about this movie.
Yeah, I mean, if possible, this looks like it might even be lower budget than Ogroff, if that's even achievable. It's extremely rare. It's one I have absolutely no context for, except it's Canadian and like barely anyone's ever seen it. But I mean, this was really digging deep, so I'm really curious about this one.
Yeah, there's quite a couple of interesting releases from MVD Visual this week. I think I'm going to have to watch out for them with future releases and see what else they can dig up from the Z-grade barrel. Let's see. SRS Cinema. I've seen a few releases from them in the past. This one seems to be interesting just based on the title alone. From 1990, it's Vampire Cop, directed by one Donald Farmer. Basically, it's a cop who's a vampire. And he teams with a reporter to bring down a crime lord. And this basically, you know, you've got what we've got out there. We've got Samurai Cop and Psycho Cop and Maniac Cop. And so why not Vampire Cop, Joel?
Yeah, Farmer's kind of an interesting figure. I've only seen one of his films, Savage Vengeance, which I watched when I was way too young to watch that one, because it's pretty much a rape revenge film. But he started out, in addition to horror films, doing a lot of documentaries, especially ones. I know he did one on Scream Queens. He did one on Jess Franco. So he seems to be kind of a scholar of the horror world as well as a director. I think most people would know him for Shark Exorcist, which came out a couple of years ago.
I love that title.
But by God, like, am I curious about Shark Exorcist? If you were ever going to come up with a shark film that miraculously hasn't been done yet, Shark Exorcist was the best possible choice you could have made.
Yeah, the title leads me to questions like, is the shark performing the exorcism, or is someone performing the exorcism on the shark?
And I think it's Exorcism on the Shark, but they've got their sequel, and I'm actually I really love to see a shark in like priest get up with the collar holding up a cross in his fin.
Yeah, I think you remember that. I don't know if you remember the cartoon from the 70s called Jabberjaw.
Oh, I love Jabberjaw.
Yeah, so let's just slap a priest collar on Jabberjaw and call it Shark Exorcist.
Oh my God, how did they not do that? That's brilliant.
We could do a Vampire Cop Shark Exorcist mashup. Oh my goodness. We're all full of ideas here. All right, so then we're getting down to our good old friends over at Shout Factory. A couple of releases this week on Blu-ray. The first one is a sci-fi classic from 1951, The Man from Planet X. Now, I'm familiar with it. I'm familiar with its cult status as a 50s sci-fi icon. But I haven't really caught the whole thing, but it's definitely interesting from a special effects standpoint, especially in regards to the alien in the film. Definitely an interesting look. And I believe this has been riffed on MST3K in the past as well. I don't know if you've seen The Man from Planet X, Joel, but I think it's definitely worth a pickup just based on the fact that it's a cult icon.
Yeah, you know, I haven't seen it, but you know, looking at stills, despite the suspect quality of the effects, like they're achieving like a really nice creepy vibe with it. And now that I'm looking at the IMDb for it, it's directed by Edgar Ulmer, who I think most people would probably know from directing The Black Cat from 1934 with Boris Karloff and Bela Lugosi.
Yeah, wow, how about that? The director, I mean, he's definitely at this point he's been around for quite a while.
Yeah, no, I mean, long career. I've seen a few of his other films, some of his noir stuff like Detour. Really great atmospheric director. Just really cool stuff he did over the course of his career. This is definitely a bit later in his career, although he was pretty active throughout the 50s and into the early 60s, but I'm not surprised that like this seems like a film that's better than its budget would indicate, because you have a real like veteran hand behind the camera.
Yeah, definitely worth a check. Also from Shout this week, a collector's edition Blu-ray for 1995's Species. Now, I've reviewed Species at RetroMovieNerd.com as well. I wasn't too kind in my review. I think I gave it a 2 out of 5, Joe. I didn't hate this movie, but it's definitely a movie that I can see some people loving, just based on a nostalgia standpoint. It was a big film from the 90s. It's been on television so many times. It's just one of those movies. You know, if it's on television, someone will leave it on in the background because it is filled with action, and it's got Natasha Henstridge in it.
Yeah, I mean, it actually does have a pretty compelling cast, most of whom are totally slumming it, like Forrest Whitaker and Alfred Molina, and Ben Kingsley. I am not a fan of it. I honestly consider it kind of misogynistic trash, and I know there's probably some of our listeners who are getting out the anti-social justice warrior pitchforks at that, but I'm sorry. Every feminist criticism made of the Alien films, which I could see might be legitimate. I think the Alien films have enough layers to sort of evade that. Every criticism leveled at the Alien films totally applies to Species and more. The only really complimentary thing I can say about it is for the first sequence of the film, when it's the Michelle Williams playing the young alien, young Syl, and that's the film I would have really loved to see. I mean, probably hindsight is 20/20 on that, because I mean, it's not like they knew Michelle Williams would go on to be one of the most like respected young actresses of her generation. But I mean, she's so evidently good. It's like, why do we even need this like post alien trash? You could have done like an interesting, creepy body horror ET, like ET Monster Squad kind of cross.
Yeah, and instead, they go with Henstridge and turn it into like a like you're stating, like a really an exploitative film.
Yeah, very much so. It's weird because it's a pure exploitation film with a real budget and real actors, like real talent behind it, which makes the whole venture seem so much worse.
Yeah, so there's our opinions on Species from 1995. But yeah, it's getting a collector's edition Blu-ray release, so if you don't already have it in your collection, maybe this is one you want to pick up if you're a fan. If you're not a fan like Joel, you're just going to ignore it. And finally, well, not finally, but we've got a few more here. Kino Lorber is putting out a couple this week, a couple of 1986 forgotten sci-fi films. I don't know if they're gems or not, Joe, but we'll be the judge of that. But a couple of Blu-ray releases from Kino. Star Crystal from 86, as we said. Not familiar with that movie. And Star Slammer with Ross Hagen. Ross Hagen, this is kind of like a women's prison movie that's set in space. It's a little more than that, but it definitely has the trappings of that in the beginning. And Ross Hagen has been in, you know, several films. He was in the 1973 exploitation, drive-in, action, sci-fi pick, Wonder Woman. And... And he was pretty good in that. So this is probably familiar territory for old Ross Hagen.
Oh yeah, I mean, veteran actor. More recently, just before about a year or so before he died, he was actually did a voice in Red Dead Redemption.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, still working even to the 2010s. I mean, you know, he was in the Hellcats, the Devil's Eight, a lot of fun, goofy exploitation biker films. You know, Star Slammer, I've actually seen. It's a Fred Olen Ray film, probably the best I've seen from him. It's like just wall to wall stupid fun. It's totally worth like a late night watch if, you know, you got nothing else going on and you really don't feel like going to bed. Aldo Ray's in it. You know, of course, sadistic female warden, she always won, is played by a woman named Maria Grant, who has a very short resume, but it's all, like, trash classics, like Hack-A-Lantern and Polish Vampire in Burbank and Cannibal Hookers. Like, just absolute bottom of the barrel, that woman mined. Like, I don't know if that was a choice. I don't know anything about her background, but I find that really fascinating. That her entire career seems made up of that.
Yeah, I guess there are plenty of actors who would follow suit with that. But yeah, definitely. I like the title Cannibal Hookers. So, I mean, you're giving me some ideas here, Joel.
Star Slammer, worth a watch. I'm not sure I'd go out of my way to buy a DVD, but what the hell? If it's on sale, I could see it being like worth a pickup just for a fun, you know, kind of meaningless goofy addition to your various marathons.
Arrow is putting out something you're anticipating here, Joel.
Oh, God bless Arrow. They are doing a DVD of the 2001 Japanese sort of mimetic internet ghost horror film Pulse. It's a film I haven't seen in a while. It's like, if you're expecting, you know, Ju-on the Grudge or expecting Ringu, it's more fragmentary. The scale is a bit bigger, like, even though they're not working with, like, the highest budget, but they really give a sense of this is a worldwide crisis, which is pretty compelling, persuasive how they do it. It's a very strange ghost movie and totally worth looking into. I remember showing it to my friends back in high school because I was just so enamored of it. And I got a lot of blank stares because they had no idea what the hell was going on. And I'm not sure I did. I loved it all the same.
Well, those are the kind of movies that you need to enjoy with friends, the ones where no one knows what the hell is going on.
The shared experience is strong with that one.
So I guess that wraps up the new releases this week, an extensive list. And
yeah, it was
a big week. In most cases, it's quite a good week. But let's move on to our main topic now, Joel. And I've been wanting to get to this for a while. Post-apocalyptic sci-fi action. We're looking at, desert landscapes like in Mad Max, and then you've got the urban decay of Escape from New York. Two films which I think influenced an entire subgenre Of course, well, when we talk about Mad Max, I think we're more specifically speaking of, the Road Warrior with marauders and roving gangs of Mohawk-headed, maniacs, and generally searching for things like water or whatever the case is. And then in your Urban Decay, you've just got, but it's pretty much the same thing. You've got an interchangeable landscape with, occupied by some of the same characters in some cases here.
Yeah, I think if there's any difference between the two is that the Urban Decay landscape is often can be sort of a segregated space or an abandoned space. Like, there's still, in a lot of those, still an overriding and usually totalitarian or oppressive government that still has a level of power. The urban space is one they're either trying to reclaim or they've just, let go to the dogs because it's too overrun with crime and with, decay. So they've let the inhabitants just deal with it. They've totally withdrawn. But, in the Road Warrior style desert films, it's, there's no central power. It's total lawlessness. I mean, even the first Mad Max feels nebulously in the future. Like, there's still obviously a police force, but you don't know how much. They seem like they're teetering on the brink all the time. And quite frankly, I'm not sure if it's actually in the future or if it's just Australia.
Yeah, those Australians, they were founded by, it used to be England's jail cell.
You
can't trust an Australian. Just look at Yahoo Sirius and Outback Jack.
Oh, you can't trust the boomerang. Yeah, if you've seen The Proposition, the Western from 2005, that's sort of how I imagine Australia to be like all the time.
Yeah, well, the post-apocalyptic, subgenre kind of, you backtrack a little bit. It's always been a topic in cinema, or rather a landscape, a setting. We've had, The Last Man on Earth, we've had The Omega Man, one notable film from the 70s, A Boy and His Dog, starring Don Johnson. They didn't really set the trend, but they were more noble films in the subgenre, especially A Boy and His Dog. For those who aren't familiar, A Boy and His Dog is, I believe, available in the public domain, and it's probably one of the more quality films that you can find in the public domain.
Oh, yeah, it's a really exceptional film. It's one of the, like Last Man on Earth, it's one of the early examples of this genre based on a famous genre story. I mean, Boy and His Dog was a novella by Harlan Ellison. Last Man on Earth, of course, being based on the Richard Matheson novel I Am Legend. It's been remade over and over. But I mean, that's in a lot of cases, I think, the genesis of this genre is. I mean, nuclear fears are of course the big catalyst, but I think so many of these stories come from sci-fi, from classic sci-fi literature, from pulp paperbacks, from, old sci-fi anthology journals, things like that. I mean, it was definitely, I think, present literarily before it was cinematically.
Yeah, and I would tend to agree with that. And the thing with the tone with, post-apocalyptic films is basically everything seems so bleak. It doesn't matter if it's you're in an urban setting or the rural or desert setting. The earth has been destroyed by war, ravaged by war, whatever the case is. But people, people continue to strive to survive. But everything is just so bleak. It's like at every turn there's just something, waiting to harm you. And I guess basically the message there is that, do what you can to survive in this setting. It's either, kill or be killed in most cases.
Yeah, very much so. I find it interesting that the genre really started to rise up when the Western became oversaturated and fell out of favor in American culture, because you've got a lot of the same feel. And of course, Westerns are, especially classic Hollywood ones, are much more law and order, much more moral. But you've still got the same bleakness, the same sense that lawlessness and wildness pervades the world around you. And, you know, in some of these, you've got someone trying to hold on, trying to bring a sort of, sort of order to the world around. Like Mad Max is, of course, the arch example there. But yeah, I mean, yeah, I remember way back when The Fifth Element came out. Either Siskel or Ebert was writing that most sci-fi movies are the same. It's the future and everything sucks.
Yeah. Even when you get the rare sci-fi film, you know, that's set in the future, everything is, I guess, even in the settings that are like in an, I guess, a state of nirvana or like a higher plane. I'm not sure how I want to express this verbally, but there's always being or a force or a committee or something over there's oversight. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Yeah, it's, and a lot of them are like false utopias, like, yeah, Logan's Run always comes to mind.
That's what I'm trying to say, a utopia. And but there's always something, you know, overseeing it, you know, setting rules.
It's a very constructed, artificially constructed, calculated society. Yeah, like, you know, even something that's a bit more optimistic, like your Star Treks. I mean, there's a Federation. There's some kind of, you know, in the more optimistic, like Star Trek settings, it's like a United Nations, but throughout space. You know, less optimistic settings or ones where it might be optimistic, but there's still a totalitarian government like a Star Wars. Like, yeah, I mean, all these films aren't those, of course, because in most cases there's a collapse on order, or there's the law and order that's around is actively making the decay worse because they're oppressive or totalitarian. I mean, you get things like, say, even into comics, of course, there's Judge Dredd is a classic example. Yeah, it's basically a really interesting, although probably overplayed at this point, catch-22, like, the world's falling apart, which makes what governments still exist worse in how they're dealing with it, which makes the world fall apart even more.
One movie that comes to mind is Soylent Green from 1973.
Yes.
I mean, here we have an overpopulated world, and what's the solution? Let's turn the people into food.
Soylent Green, I think a lot of people haven't really checked it out because they already know the twist, but that might hurt some people's enjoyment because at heart it's structured like a detective story. But I think people, it's really worth checking out just for the performances and I never expected this the first time I watched it. There's a real heartfelt connection between Edward G. Robinson and Charlton Heston in it. We tend to associate 70s sci-fi with, of course, bleakness and coldness, like, but they're not all like styled like THX 1138 or something. Like, this has a lot of heart to it. It's a really remarkable film. I never expected what it was when I first watched it.
Yeah, and I agree with that point you make about the relationship between Charlton Heston and Edward G. Robinson. That was probably the consider, especially towards the end of the film, that was really the heart of the whole thing. And because Edward G. Robinson was around before things fell apart, and he remembers, you know, he remembers apples, he remembers steak, because everyone in that future is eating Soylent Green and surviving off of that. And of course, you know, that was really just a, and that being Robinson's final role was, you know, an appropriate way for him to go out.
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, that's a pretty inspired casting. I mean, you know, a detective story set in the future, and you get, you know, an old Edward G. Robinson as one of your primary characters. It's just phenomenal work. Just the whole thing is really a constant surprise because everything it sets up, it obviously it's become so memetic. It's such an iconic film with such an iconic twist ending that people think they know the whole thing going in, but there's so much more to it. I'm just really impressed by that film.
Yeah, and I'm also a fan of that film. I've even got a T-shirt in honor of that film. Yeah, it's basically the print on the shirt says the Soylent Corporation, and it's like the recycling logo with stick figures going around. So it's quite a funny shirt. So I get the odd person, you know, who gets it and compliments me on it from time to time. Most people don't get it. Yeah, so Soylent Green, and you mentioned Logan's Run. I guess, yeah, this counts as in the subgenre. I'm not a fan of Logan's Run as much. I kind of thought, you know, when Michael York had fled the dome, the city, and I really lost it when they were in the ice cave with the robot. I mean, that's really where it started to fall apart for me. But I mean, Logan's Run is a cult favorite of a lot of people, and it definitely gets mentioned in this and talk of this subgenre. And I guess you know, to check it out at least once, because the special effects, this is pre-Star Wars, and when Star Wars came out in 77, I mean, that set the standard for science fiction special effects at that point. So, you know, Logan's Run being pre-Star Wars, the special effects probably, you know, don't hold up as well now, but, you know, this was top-notch special effects cinema, you know, in 1976.
Yeah. And I'm actually a huge Logan's Run fan, partly because it's just so full of weird, interesting ideas, like, that even any, you know, even though the narrative jumps around a lot, like, I'm just a fan of the world it's building. I mean, if you're a fan of world building, like, it's definitely a sci-fi film for you. And, you know, I'm just really interested in, like, it's telling a story and telling ideas that you don't necessarily see a lot. I mean, ideas that, especially a very, I'm not trying to sound like a cranky old man, but a very visual youth-oriented culture, that there's dignity and wisdom associated with aging. That aging is a natural element of humanity and should be prized in its own way. And I mean, that's a very specific sort of, I think, American idea. I mean, there are other countries that, you know, are so preeminently patriarchal or so so heavily about respect for the elderly that I think viewers in those countries would be amazed that this is kind of revolutionary in an American film. But also, I'm just a big Michael York fan, and especially the scene where he's finding out what he has to do, and he's kind of finding out at least elements of the truth about the society he's in. It's like watching a man being told everything he's believed in is a lie, which is really interesting. He's got this, like, almost, like, supernaturally perfect face. it's sculpted out of, like, marble, and you're seeing, like, emotion enter into it for, like, the first time in the film, really, and it's just a really weird, like, like, the scene itself is really good anyway, and it's a really, like, you know, it's a really, like, stomach-churning scene just watching this guy's, like, whole worldview fall apart in front of you. But it's even weirder because you're in this, like, very surface level, placid, like absolutely simple society, and everything's so anodyne and so sculpted, yeah. And he's a perfect representative of it. And to watch that fall apart, it has a really weird effect.
What about that scene? You know, the ceremony of the people who.
Carousel.
That's what I'm talking about.
Oh my God! Like that's such a great, like, just dramatic irony, like in the classic sense. Like, you know exactly what's going on, and you're just horrified not only because you're watching this, but because you realize no one watching this understands.
Yeah, I mean, that was for me the beginning, probably the first half of the film for me. I enjoyed, you know, the chase through the city, the escape attempt. That was a good movie. That was a good half of the movie. But like I said, once they reach the ice cave and the robot that has frozen people who have gotten that far, it's just, oh my gosh, I don't know. That took me out of it.
It is kind of a shaggy narrative by that point. I can totally understand.
Yeah. So basically, and let's get to let's go back up to, I guess, the Mad Max era here, and the influence. We'll start with the Mad Max and the Road Warrior, Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. This whole trilogy was routinely an influence on subgenre films of this like throughout the 80s. This is basically your desert landscape, your post-apocalyptic desert. You know, you've got Mad Max. We mentioned that they hadn't gone to the brink just yet. There is still law and order. Although we don't know what good it will do, because everything is just so chaotic anyway. I mean, it's almost like they're handcuffed a lot of times about, you know. Especially in terms of the number of staff they have. And there's only like a handful of police officers, and we've got people, you know, raiding throughout the landscape, you know, Tool Cutter and his gang. But then by the time Mad Max 2, The Road Warrior, rolls around, everything's gone to shit. There's no roads left. There's really no civilization of any kind except these makeshift shanty towns that crop up. The goal seems to be gasoline. Lord Humongous and his gang in the Road Warrior trying to steal gasoline from, you know, the residents of the shantytown who are, you know, protecting it very closely. And I just want to make note that the Road Warrior was my first experience with Vernon Wells, the great, you know, the great Australian.
Yes.
He's been in so much stuff. And yeah, so, you know, most people are familiar with Vernon Wells as Bennett in Commando, but, you know, he was great in The Road Warrior. It's one of the scenes I enjoy is his little fancy boy there getting KO'd with the boomerang and him freaking out over it. Vernon Wells, great, you know, underrated character actor from Australia. Was perfect for that role. I think really the subgenre took off after The Road Warrior was released in terms of, you know, copycat films.
Oh, very much so. I mean, The Road Warrior is a particular bit of brilliance. Just everything came together perfectly. I love the first Mad Max. Road Warrior might be even better. Partly, like, so much, there's so much talent behind this film. I mean, Dean Semler on cinematography, who, you know, would go on to do a ton of films. Mostly, this was probably his breakthrough, although he was already a veteran of cinematography, camera operation, second unit direction, worked on a lot of documentaries and films before this. But I mean, he went on to do like a ton of films where he was the only good part of the film, stuff like Waterworld. But also, he did Last Action Hero. I mean, he's just incredibly, incredibly adaptable cinematographer to tons of different styles. But, I mean, he's obviously at his best with these wide motifs. I mean, one of the things that Road Warrior does brilliantly is taking this post-apocalyptic idea and putting it, like, crafting a wandering sort of Ronin or wandering gunslinger feel onto it to put it in like a realm people understand. I mean, it's just, you can totally see why this created a genre. I mean, visually like the landscapes are amazing. The costuming, it's Norma Morisot who did the great Rock and Roll Swindle, the Sex Pistols film. And actually, we had the unfortunate experience of doing the costume design for The Island of Dr. Moreau. But, you know, it came up with some extremely brilliant punk-styled I think that's another reason why this created a genre, because the idea of putting incorporating all that, like, all these elements from these, at the time, fairly fringe cultures, punk rock, and all this, like, leather S&M kind of style to all these costumes. I mean, you look at, like, say, Lord Humongous, and he's, like, this S&M Jason Voorhees warlord. It's just, everything is just a brilliant visual in this film. And also, you can see where it created its own genre, because literally, you're getting a bunch of dirty, huge guys out in the desert with some junker cars and prop guns and throwing them at each other. Like, you can understand why this is an attractive idea for filmmakers, because all they have to do is take a low-budget B filmmakers, because all they have to do is find a sufficiently bleak, desolate location, you know, get a ruggedly handsome leading man and a bunch of ugly punks and just throw them out there.
Yeah, it seems like a pretty, you know, simple idea in terms of location scouting and things like that. And so it makes things a little bit easier, you know, in terms of where to shoot. I think you mentioned the costuming. I think really Mad Max and the Road Warrior itself influenced costuming in action sci-fi films, because even if you're not in the desert landscape or the urban decay or whatever the case is, you know, you've got, in the 80s, you've got these, you've got movies with street gangs in them. We're talking like Exterminator and Exterminator 2 here, I have specifically in mind. You know, definitely, you know, everything, it's present day, the setting is present day, but the villains in the film are still dressed like something out of Mad Max.
Yeah, it's almost like it took over people's idea of what, like, punk subcultures were, of what gangs looked like. Like, everyone was an evil punk rocker in the 80s. If you weren't an evil punk rocker, you were the working-class guy whose family just got killed by them.
Yeah, he did this, yeah, well, that costuming even extends to something like Death Wish 3, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, like, all these supposedly, like, realistic, like, modern... modern films about crime, like every criminal is like a cartoon punk rocker, pro wrestler,
oversized mohawk and the leather jacket with spikes, the gloves, spikes, you know. They're wearing like a mesh tank top or something, and they've got the eye makeup, you know, the little war paint on their face, and it's just. So even if you're not in a post-apocalyptic setting, the Road Warrior was still influential on the action genre itself in that respect.
Yeah, and what you say about, like, the war paint, like, I think that's one of the reasons this idea persisted, that tribal sense of this makeup, which is, of course, what was kind of a common denominator of a lot of subcultures, especially in the 70s and 80s, especially punk rock, even early hip-hop, like, just even, you know, 90s era hip-hop, the sense that you were identified with specific dang specific tribes. Like, it just you know, it's sort of people's idea of like crime of gangs before that were like well-dressed mobsters. Like, so the idea that there's all these like street urchin kids like making these like gangs that don't even seem like they're within the bounds of crime, because traditional mob crime, as brutal as it could be, was generally almost not gentlemanly, but kind of an expected way to commit crime. It was like a formalized idea of crime. And now you've got, and people's idea of like punk rockers, of like, you know, city gangs, like pre-Bloods and Crips kind of gangs, like the idea that they're not committing crimes within our world, that they're part of this lawless realm that's somewhere outside our world and they've broken in. Like, that was a really resonant idea for people because they had no idea what to make of crime anymore.
And I just wanted to mention, I've mentioned this in the past, but I just wanted to mention one of my favorite things about Exterminator 2, Mario Van Peebles and his gang. We're still in present day New York, but the gang hangs out underground and they still use lit torches when they have their meetings.
Which is amazing. Like, that was another thing. Everyone's idea of New York was that there's all sorts of dangers in the sewers. I worry for Mario Van Peebles down there, because if they flood it with like Chud waste every night, like in Jason Takes Manhattan, I don't know what they're
gonna do. I think Mario Van Peebles as a Chud would have worked.
Oh God, perfect movie.
So we're talking about the influence that Mad Max trilogy really had on the rest of the subgenre. But I want to take the opportunity out there to talk about a set of films that I've been watching. A post-apocalyptic landscape, but these are in a desert landscape, and these were produced by Roger Corman and directed by one Sergio H. Santiago. I don't know what the H stand for. Maybe it stands for
Hell's a Poppin'.
Sergio Hell's a Poppin' Santiago. And this series of films, we start with Striker, a film called Striker from 1983, and then we go from there to The Sisterhood, Equalizer 2000, even into the early 90s he did Dune Warriors. There's also one called Wheels of Fire. Y'all, look those up, y'all, because these are a quintet of films that he directed that take place in the post-apocalyptic desert landscape. I've got them on DVD, and there's a trailer section on each DVD. The trailers refer to each of the other films in the collection. But when you watch the trailers, and I shit you not, all the movies look the same. We've got the junker cars racing through the desert. Someone claims that we've got to protect the water. There's spikes and leather and crossbows and all sorts of shit running through all of these movies. They all look the same, and it's quite hilarious once you get through the trailer. I was watching one with Mrs. Jordan once, and you know, she said out loud the same thing I was thinking, was that, is this the same movie that we just saw the trailer for? And no, it's not the same movie, but they do look the same. And, you know, Sergio Santiago has done quite a few different types of films. A lot of work in the 70s and whatnot in the exploitation genre. I think he's Filipino. Is that right, Joel? He's a Filipino director? Yeah.
Yeah, no. He pretty much is the Filipino film industry. like he was so prolific. I'm a big fan of his, and he also crossed over with some of our some American stuff. I mean, he did work with Corman, of course. He did work with Jack Hill. He produced Big Birdcage and Big Dollhouse. You know, he did so he was, of course, involved in a lot of exploitation genres. I think most people would say his 70s stuff is probably his best. I think Death Force from 78 probably is his best film that I've seen so far. But I haven't seen his post-apocalyptic one, so I might change my mind once I, you know, separate those enough to tell them apart.
Yeah, good luck with that. Yeah, so I just wanted to take the opportunity out to recommend a Sergio Santiago collection. We don't get to do that too often, but these are the ones to check out, I think, especially if you're looking for this particular subgenre. I think what we'll do, Joel, we'll take a quick break, and on the other side, we'll get into the influence that Escape from New York has had on. We've kind of touched on some of it already, but let's delve a little bit further into it. We can talk Escape from New York. We can talk little John Carpenter and the influence that this film has had on the action sci-fi subgenre. So stay with us. We'll have a short promo, and when we come back, we'll keep rolling.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the pro wrestling only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with clotheslines and headlines, main event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. And we leave wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the Our Vantage Point podcast, which features a potpourri-style look at wrestling history, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler podcast, Our Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and the Imaginary Stories. You can find all these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows plus others available at PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlayStation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Subscribe on iTunes or on Android with your favorite podcast app. Established in 2013, the Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network is committed to providing unique takes on the rich and diverse medium of professional wrestling, focusing on its history and global impact, but also exploring the vibrant contemporary scene. The roll call includes Space City, an NWA On Demand podcast, This Week in Wrestling, Stacy and Elliott's Bogus Journey, the Super Apoitas podcast, the Military Industrial Suplex, Strong Style History, Puro Puri, and Psychology is Dead. Also, from the archives, the full catalog of great shows that provided a fresh look at classic wrestling, including Where the Big Boys Play, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, Letters from Kayfabe, Wrestling Culture, Pro Wrestling Super Show, Goodwill Wrestling, and many, many others. Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Only the best.
Welcome back. Glad you could join us. We're talking post-apocalyptic copycat blues here at Go Home in the Box. Talking about the influence that movies like Mad Max and Escape from New York had on the action sci-fi subgenre. We've discussed Mad Max before the break. Well, let's get into some Escape from New York here. 1981, John Carpenter brings Escape from New York to the screen and set off a chain of copycat films throughout the VHS era. Now, the original, yeah, big fan of the original, starring Kurt Russell and Harry Dean Stanton, Adrian Barbeau, Donald Pleasance. Some of these actors were already staples in, you know, Carpenter's cadre of actors that he liked to rework with. And, you know, the whole, Joel, the whole urban decay futuristic setting, kind of, the films were, you know, kind of almost similar in style. You had, there was always a king of the mountain, so to speak, in the urban setting, because basically there was no, all this, like the lawlessness that we applied to the desert landscape, like we said, we're now taking it into an urban setting. The influence here is very strong in you know, subsequent films like 1999 Escape from the Bronx and you know, other films of that nature. But so which aspect of this, Joel, do you think really sticks out as the you know, the leading I guess trope of the genre?
Ooh, yeah, that's a tough one because, like you said, so many of the tropes cross over with the Mad Max style of post-apocalyptic films. I think one of the things that really caught on was the oppressive government trope, because, like you said, there's like a King of the Hill, like, you know, the Duke of New York and Escape from New York, but there's always the sense that it's a very big fish, small pond situation because they're the king of a garbage dump. Outside, there's an actual world. There's an actual world that's going on, if not as normal, like one that has more opportunity in it. So I mean, with, like, you know, a Mad Max kind of film, being king of the landscape there means you're king of everything because there's nothing there. There's nothing outside it. But yeah, like that sort of oppressive government, or, you know, government that marginalizes and segregates people, is really pervasive in the Escape from New York style. So even stuff it influenced, like, I mean, you know, it made its way into a Batman comic. For those of our readers who remember Batman No Man's Land, about came out around the late 90s, early 2000s, if I remember right, which was you know, kind of a nonsense story in which, because of a giant earthquake, Gotham City was cut off from the rest of America. America basically decided, you know, go for it. Just you do you. Which, I mean, you can't imagine. That story doesn't work in a fairly modern, like, normal set. In a world where there's still, like, a reasonably democratic government and, yeah, and crime is relatively, like, I mean, crime rates in the real world in America have been dropping steadily for years and years, and they really perk up during recessions, or, yeah, the worst crime rate in America was the Great Depression, which, I mean, makes a lot of sense. That's why these films have to be set in the future, because you need to play, for this idea to work, it needs to be in a place where everything's so far over the edge that it can't be, that decisions have to be made by a central power about what can be saved and what can't be saved.
Yeah, I think in Escape from New York, we kind of get a peek into it, but it seems to be kind of like a militaristic power in place, because basically all we see is the police taking Snake Plissken and explaining to him what's going on and what he needs to do, and we don't really get to see much of the outside world. And so it makes me think that really it's kind of like a military state.
It's hard to tell in Escape from New York because, like you said, we only get that very small perspective of this outside world. I mean, we do know that there does seem to still be some level of the Cold War still going on. Like, there's definitely does seem to be still the threat of nuclear war, a lot of tension between America and presumably Russia or other major world powers. In other films in this genre, in this subgenre, or films that incorporate elements like, say, RoboCop, yeah, even, where there tends to be like some kind of corporate military industrial complex element, where it almost feels like the implication is small town America, rural America, the heartland, they're fairly quotidian, like fairly day to day as we know it, but the urban areas are the ones where the blight has set in most, which is funny to think of now with what we know about how the state of America now, because the biggest like problems with meth, with heroin, are all in the rural areas now.
Yeah. Yes,
but I mean, that of course doesn't underscore. I mean, certainly there are urban areas that still have problems, but it's a very specific view of the future built on a pre-gentrification kind of New York, like before something like New York became a cultural tourist mecca, when it was still, there were neighborhoods you just did not go into at night. Like, that was the New York. That was the New York that led to 1997's maximum security prison, New York.
Yeah, and
that, I mean, it's like, oh, I'm sorry. That was such a major trope in the 70s and 80s, not just for New York, but for, you get Detroit and RoboCop, the idea that either a military-industrial complex is going to step in and reclaim this urban space and remake it into something futuristic and valuable for real estate mavens and corporations again, or they're just going to let go to absolute hell and just let it deal with its own problems.
Yeah. Yeah, all very good points, and so the whole ideas presented there is really a big influence on subsequent movies from that. But let's talk about John Carpenter for a second, because he did 1976. He did Assault on Precinct 13. Now, I'm not going to necessarily say that this is a post-apocalyptic, but some of the same tone is there. I mean, there is like this one isolated police station and these nameless, almost faceless attackers, looting, trying to break into the place. And it's kind of similar in tone to a lot of these, these people have to take a stand against this, gang of street punks. And that definitely, I think, has a similar tone in nature to some of this future stuff.
Oh, yeah, you can definitely see where the one leads to the other. I think one of the tropes Carpenter, not just him, but helped institute, that, I think you'll find in a lot of, like, 70s blaxploitation films and gang films, is the idea that you can feel that kind of isolation in like the most populous place in the country.
Right.
Like, I think that was a real revelation for audience. I mean, not just outside like cities who were, I mean, even growing up in like a more recent era, there was still Yeah, I can remember the 90s. People still thought of New York as Taxi Driver.
Yeah.
Like, they really thought you'd go down Times Square and still be nothing but, like, hookers.
Yeah, New York really has taken a beating in the 70s and 80s in terms of how the movies depict New York. You know, Death Wish had muggers around every corner. You know, dirty, rotten buildings just decaying everywhere. I mean, people legitimately believe that this was how New York looked.
I'm not sure there was one cop in Jason Takes Manhattan. And, you know, that's 1989. Like, Manhattan as a police force larger than the amount of soldiers we initially sent into Iraq in our invasion.
Yeah. So, and so Carpenter, of course, I think he's always had a fixation on, you know, the apocalypse or a post-apocalyptic world, because he has quite a extensive list of films that, you know, talk about the end of the world or have circumstances that will possibly bring about, you know, the end of things as we know it. We talk about The Thing. The Thing is a good example of that. This alien, you know, parasite, you know, if this thing escapes from the Arctic Circle, you know, it's going to wreak havoc on the population. We've also got, you know, Prince of Darkness, Satan, or whatever he is, locked up in a cylinder in green ooze, you know, waiting to be unleashed. We got characters in that film that are having those, you know, signal the dreams, the transmissions from the future, definitely signaling, you know, some type of end of the world scenario, as well as you know, the film In the Mouth of Madness. So I mean, Carpenter definitely, you know, he escaped from New York. Really, he set the thing. He had the setting in, you know, the future, probably after shit went down. But these other films, Thing and Prince of Darkness and In the Mouth of Madness, these really signal the end of things to come.
Yeah, and Prince of Darkness is also a weirdly good example of what we're talking about. I mean, we talk of Carpenter and the apocalypse. Carpenter in Isolation is always really interesting, and like Prince of Darkness is another one where the circumstances that could tear apart the world are right in the middle of a city. I mean, that's in a church in Los Angeles. It's not like, you know, I mean, In the Mouth of Madness is much more H.P. Lovecraft, where, you know, things are sort of in frighteningly creepy, desolate areas of New England or wherever, but that the end of the world is in a basement in Los Angeles is not like a typical horror trope.
No, they're not. And also, may I add that Prince of Darkness is still a highly underrated horror film. I just want to get that out there, Joel.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think it does not get enough love when people talk about 80s horror, but Prince of Darkness is definitely, I think, if I had to make a list, I would put it in my top 10.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just a case where the bar is so high for 80s horror that a lot of stuff doesn't get enough recognition because there's so much good stuff out there.
Yeah. So, yeah, you know, the Carpenter has this, you know, this fixation on, you know, the apocalypse or, you know, things to come, and definitely portrayed that in Escape from New York. And so that was, and he being a very influential director that he is, you know, he, we get a lot of copycats of, especially of the Escape from New York style type of action sci-fi film. You know, yeah.
Yeah, I would even say, I would even say that one of the tropes that Escape from New York sort of established that has been used ad nauseum, like, you know, if Mad Max could be described as like a wandering gunslinger or a wandering Ronin, I'd almost say that Snake Plissken, like, his type became a new type of action hero, like the sort of embittered ex-Special Forces guy. you know, I mean, there's been embittered ex-soldiers before, but I feel like that particular variety that Snake Plissken sort of represents was fairly new with him. And of course, that he is very obviously the basis for Solid Snake from Metal Gear Solid. I mean, it's gotten to the point where instead of like very wandering cowboy type characters, like if there's a rugged grizzled action film hero, he's probably going to be like, if not a current soldier, he's going to be a bitter ex-soldier. And that's, I think that very much came to the forefront of State of New York.
Yeah, definitely. I guess we'll call it like an anti-hero. You know, he's not virtuous or wholesome in any respect. He's definitely got his flaws, but he's reluctantly forced into action. There might be some mutual benefits to, you know, saving the world or whatever the case is, but you know, definitely the anti-hero was established with Snake Plissken.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like Mad Max is more of a man with no name type, more of a Yojimbo type. Like, yeah, I think Snake Plissken really had a lot of influence on the development of Wolverine as a character in particular.
Yeah, I can see that, definitely. Yeah.
To the point where Logan feels like, in its own way, it could be an Escape from New York kind of film.
Yeah, and I think I think the Snake Plissken character itself might be a callback to, you know, a lot of you know, spaghetti westerns, definitely from that mold of you know, the guy that roams into town. He's not exactly a hero, but he's you know, he sees a benefit in you know, taking on, you know, the villains of the story, for whatever reason that may be. He has his own reasons, but he's more of like doing it for selfish reasons.
Yeah, actually, I think there's also a lot of precedent there with the Dirty Dozen and the sort of deconstructionist war films of the late 60s, early 70s. Like, because Snake's an interesting case where he's not doing it for a selfish reason, really. He's coerced, and he's going to die if he doesn't.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
I think like an element of that, like, of course, that was, you know, there was an element of that in Dirty Dozen, although they were actively working for, like, a pardon. You know, this would like the, you know, nano explosive thing would become a plot point in Suicide Squad, the comic. And then, of course, get reused for the Suicide Squad movie. I think just that, and a lot of sequences in Suicide Squad, the movie, by the way, are just wholesale ripoffs of Escape from New York.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think with a lot of these copycat films, you know, in the Escape from New York genre style, the hero is a lot like Snake Plissken. He's like the loner who is reluctant. He reluctantly joins forces with you know, some of the other characters to accomplish, you know, a means to an end. Maybe he was, you know, maybe he was wronged by the villain also, and he just wants revenge. And basically, the Snake Plissken character itself, you know, influenced along with Escape from New York, just the style of character in the lead in these films, just a guy who wants to be left alone, but he's, you know, forced to, you know, help some people out.
Yeah, oh, very much so. I mean, I'd say there's even, like, a level with, because that could, like, broadly describe, like, a lot of Clint Eastwood characters, too. I think there's even a level at which he's, the Snake Plissken style character is even more selfish and more, more apathetic than that. Like, he's, a lot of elements of him where he's actively opposed out, or, you know, a lot of these characters, they have backstories where they were somehow involved in the oppressive force, like they were part of it. Maybe they didn't realize what it was. Maybe they just didn't care. Like, there's a real mercenary quality to them that you don't necessarily see in the Mad Max type hero all the time, because they tend to be someone who sees the value in some way of protecting people. Like, the Snake Plissken type just is trying to get through the next day.
Right, yeah. And he doesn't particularly, yeah, he doesn't particularly care for the cast characters that are, you know, running alongside him. You know, especially, well, in Harry Dean Stanton's case, you know, the character of Brain, their former partners, and Brain screwed him over on a job and took off. And yeah, so there's no, I guess, sympathy coming from the character of Snake. And that goes with the anti-hero stuff that we're talking about. I mean, he's the hero of the film, but he's not a nice guy. But we have to root for him because, you know, he's the one that's going to be doing all the ass-kicking.
Yeah, and he's also the one that's bad. Yeah, like, Escape from New York gets it right by putting him into a situation that, like, you know, he's so put upon in terms of being forced to do this that you can understand why he hates this. And also, I think one of the things a lot of these films do is give the hero is a sidekick who's supposed to soften them up a bit. I mean, sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't. Here, it's Ernest Borgnine, so it obviously more than works.
Yeah.
But like, you know, at worst, you could end up with, like, Rob Schneider and Judge Dredd.
Oh, my goodness. You went there. That's a story for another day, the Rob Schneider and Judge Dredd. But, you know, this was big influence on a lot of the Italian action sci-fi films that came out in the 80s. I mean, we had a glut of these, like 1990, The Bronze Warriors. I want to say Warriors of the Wasteland, but maybe that was more of a Mad Max style. But
a little bit more. I mean, that was because let's also notice the New Barbarians, right? The one with Fred William.
Yeah, yeah. He's in that. But it was really what else? I don't know. To a lesser extent, maybe Class of 1984. But the Italians really jumped on this genre in the 80s.
Oh yeah, I mean, yeah, they crossed over. They did a lot of crossing over between this and the Mad Max films. I mean, you know, Enzo Castellari did a lot of these. I'm not surprised because, like I mentioned, there's definitely a through line from the Dirty Dozen to Escape from New York, and you know, he did his own Dirty Dozen style film with the Inglourious Basterds. So of course, he did 1990, The Bronx Warriors, and its sequel, Escape from the Bronx, which I think are probably like the apex of the Italian Mad Max Escape from New York ripoffs.
Yeah.
And these are examples, of course, of ones that are like in the urban setting. Like, there's a huge military industrial complex, like, tramping everything down under its boot heel. You know, 1990, The Bronx Warriors even, like co-opts the main plot of Escape from New York. Instead of trying to find the president, the main character, Trash, who's a member of one of the main New York gangs, finds the heiress to a military industrial arms company and is protecting her because she doesn't actually want to inherit the company she's going to.
Yeah.
So there's a little more. Like, there's a little more of a, it's almost a little more of a moral spectrum in these films than Escape from New York itself, where almost everyone is self-interested. Like, I mean, from, you know, it's very clear that there's no difference in kind between between Donald Pleasance, you know, Isaac Hayes's Duke of New York. They're the same person, just in different circumstances.
Hey, I want to mention real quick, you know, the scene where the Duke of New York is introduced to the plot when he's riding in the Cadillac with the chandeliers. Oh,
yes.
That is such a great entrance. You know, that would make a great WrestleMania entrance, just a cavalcade of Cadillacs with chandeliers as hood ornaments, and that disco beat. Dude, I just want to throw it out.
Oh my God, if only they had someone cool enough to do that. Like, Misha Banks could try that. Win some of her NXT goodwill back.
Yeah, I wanted to also mention the fact that we're talking 1990, the Bronx Warriors. There was a man in this film by the name of Marco Di Gregorio, a.k.a. Mark Gregory, who was somewhat of an icon in Italian action sci-fi films. I reviewed a film way back when my site was known as B-Movie Memories called Warbus 2. Not related to Warbus 1 in any way. But Mark Gregory is a guy that probably could have transitioned into American films if he had stuck with it. But yeah, he's pretty good here as Trash in Bronx Warriors. And the sequel as well.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny, the cult for these films is extremely large to the point that there's a I don't know if they're still doing it, but there was a convention for these films in Italy.
Oh yeah, wow, how about that? Yeah, I can see that these films probably made a ton of money in Italy.
I think one of the things is not only that they're incorporating elements of two very successful and popular films, but they also incorporate heavy elements from the Warriors, and that there's very distinct, almost cartoony gangs with very distinct identities.
Like a roller skating street gang. What are they called? The Zombies?
Yeah. Yeah. No, there's like almost a cabaret mime kind of gang. Like the gangs are just very colorful in this, so it's a really easy film series to really just like get lost in the world around this series, because I mean you've got like giant corporations on top who need to be toppled, man needs to be fought, and there's all these like politics between these extremely like interesting weird gangs, and there's all sorts of different like Escape from New York is pretty consistent in tone, but like this is a film series that just throws stuff out there just to see what it just wants to see what you like. Just here's some weird shit, go for it.
Yeah, you know,
like, and you know,
oh, no, I was just going to mention you mentioned the Warriors, and I'm kind of curious because I haven't delved into the backstory of that actual plot a whole lot. I mean, I've seen the movie and I know the Warriors like the back of my hand, but the setting it kind of lends itself to this subgenre as well somewhat, because you've got hundreds of guys in just various gangs meeting, you know, meeting in this one spot near the beginning of the film, and it's like there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of law and order in this setting, and so you know I think the Warriors itself might actually have a bit of a little bit to say in this genre.
Oh yeah, I mean there's definitely elements of the Warriors in this genre. Because I think this was just a consistent fear for people around this time period, just that urban decay would lead to wider social collapse. It just a consistent fear. I mean, the Warriors itself, I mean, look at how controversial even the movie poster was, talking about, these are the armies of the night. They, you know, outnumber the police. Like the idea of all this very primal, like very street urchin crime coming together to become something stronger in unity was like a really compelling idea for people, because people, like us earlier, like people were used to the idea of gangs as like the Italian mafia. There was presumably some kind of order, some kind of rank within the gang, some kind of even criminal morality, you could call it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And just like your roving gangs of marauders in, like, Mad Max or, you know, Escape from New York.
Yeah, like, but people see that as, like, true lawlessness. If a gang is acting like a corporation, people are comfortable with that. People are comfortable. If they're acting like a family, people are comfortable with that. Like, that's why, like, it always interests me that all the corporations in these films, like, these, you know, global corporate, and that's another concern that's, like, really running through this, like, people afraid of globalization. I'll get to that in a bit, but, like, these are basically just corporate gangs. They're not, but they're rigidly structured. They're not the wild, untamed, like, biker gangs that you find, but they're not really different in morality or even not necessarily in practice either.
Yeah, exactly. All good points out that. And I think we'll lump the Warriors in here with this, because it kind of has the same, you know, the same tone and some of the same tropes that these other films have. You know, this is Escape from New York especially, but still has an influence on some films from some current films that we want to get into, and you mentioned the globalization aspect as well. I want you to touch on that a little bit. We'll just try to get into the globalization part, and then let's talk about also the influence that is still prevalent today in some of today's films.
Yeah, you know, I think the fears of globalization have changed from this era. I mean, you know, this was an era where, like, gun-toting guys in the woods thought the UN was representative of some kind of new world order that was somehow tied into the Book of Revelations, implanting computer chips into people's wrists to give them the mark of the beast. Like, these, and that's, by the way, another thing we didn't really touch on in this discussion is that all the end times Book of Revelations films that were going on around the time, like Thief in the Night.
Oh, yeah,
all the
Mark of the Beast.
Those always fascinate me. That's like a separate thing. Has are the very serious post-apocalyptic films like Threads and the Day After. I really felt like making it through this week, so I didn't really want to get into those. But, so concerns of globalization now, like, I don't know if you've been watching American Gods.
No, I haven't.
I've only caught some clips, mostly because Crispin Glover is playing the leader of the new gods, Mr. World, who is the god of globalization. On YouTube, there's a pretty great promo clip of him giving this really involved speech about consumer choice as it relates to salsa. Just phenomenal, and because it's Crispin Glover, even better than ever imagined.
Crispin Glover's trying to sell you on salsa?
He's talking about how salsa represents globalization, basically. Okay. How the entire world is sort of congealing into one thing. But our concerns about globalization now are more corporatized. Like, you know, there's the bomb movie that came out not long ago, The Circle, which was obviously like, you know, this is Google, this is Amazon turned evil. Yeah. Eviler. You know, it was Crispin Glover. Someone said, "Did Jeff Bezos just give this speech about Amazon buying Whole Foods?" back in the era of this film, like, our concerns were like a one world government, like that was possible in the Cold War. Like, the UN was going to like make the new world order, and there were going to be black helicopters watching us all day. Now our concerns are corporations owning the rest of the planet and sending drones to watch us all day. It's only kind of a difference in kind rather than degree. It's still the same thing, but just for a different source. So, you know, I'm still waiting for the era of, like, corporate post-apocalyptic films. I'm not sure they're coming, because all of our post-apocalyptic needs are sort of fulfilled by zombies now.
Yeah, it was surprising we're still not through the zombie phase. Because the vampire phase, you know, brought on by Twilight only lasted like 2-3 years. Now the zombie phase is going up on almost 8 or 9 years now.
Here's what I've learned. I think the vampire phase passed through quickly because the teenage girls whose libidos were satiated by that moved on to, grew up and got boyfriends, and the next wave of teenage girls were just interested in, like, One Direction or whatever. But The Walking Dead appeals to really sad sack men who really think they'd survive a zombie apocalypse and love making plans for that. And those men will never grow past that.
Yeah, they probably some of these guys may have wound up on that old Nat Geo program, Doomsday Preppers.
Yeah, they probably
did. That show.
Like, no one's ever prepped for the same Doomsday twice on that show, have they? Like, everyone's got a different idea of what's going to kill us, and you can't prepare for all of them. That's the funny thing. We don't really get post-apocalyptic films or stories in the same sense anymore. It's almost like the ones we are getting are almost nostalgic now. Like, they're almost based on, it's almost like nostalgia for the fear of a previous era, which I find interesting. I'm talking about Turbo Kid especially. I'm talking about the My Chemical Romance album, Danger Days, The True Lives of the Fabulous Killjoys, which also spawned a comic book based on it. If you're skeptical about My Chemical Romance because of their earlier, foppish emo dandy phase, just check out the videos for this album because they're very much, I would almost call them like tributes to Escape from the Bronx. They feel very much like that sort of hokey 80s, laser apocalypse future. Like, the guns they're using are clearly modeled after or may even be repurposed NES Zappers. the villain is a robotic Grant Morrison.
Oh my.
I was going to say that
Mrs. Jordan is a big fan of the emo My Chemical Romance. She wasn't a fan after the Black Parade. Sorry.
I am a fan of emo My Chemical Romance, but I'm even more a fan of Danger Days era because it's sort of them, like, they're very much doing the Warriors. They're doing Akira, which is another thing we didn't really bring up. I mean, Japan has its own idea of the post-apocalypse, and Akira is the definitely arch example of that, and that's an entire other show because there's so much to that comic and movie. It's still got a crossover element. I mean, there's a biker gang at the center of it. There's, a military-industrial complex. There's more weird government, science experiments because Japan, Japanese film tends to prize that more. We kind of stopped doing that after 50s movies. Maybe a little bit in the 80s. Stephen King was into that stuff with, Firestarter. And that's another, we're very nostalgic for the fears of a previous generation. So, Stranger Things, even though it's not really apocalyptic, in the sense we're talking about today, that's immersed in 80s nostalgia and fear. But yeah, Turbo Kid and Danger Days are very much pay-ons to that era and what people are afraid of. And also I was saying with zombie films today, Walking Dead especially, and people's and the zombie survival guide, people planning for a fake apocalypse, that there's an element of gamesmanship in the older apocalypses too. Part of the appeal is imagining yourself surviving it and dealing with the wasteland and being the most badass son of a bitch on a bike with your ragged clothing and broken sunglasses and your really weird weaponry. There's a childishness to it in a weird way. It's based on adult fears, but it's almost comforting you with a childhood war game.
Yeah, and definitely. And I think when you were talking about one-upmanship and basically, I've got I've got a bazooka, you've only got a shotgun, and I've got like 800 cans of beefaroni, and you've only got like 200. So I mean, I've actually seen that. I've seen that, you know, with the show Doomsday Preppers, and I've seen it online, and you know, people bragging that they're ready for it, come and take it. You know what I mean?
You know, it's very much, I mean, now I'm going to get a little politicized, not sure, but it's very much the sentiment that I think, in particular, certain lobbying groups have tried to foster in the gun owner community. And, of course, there are plenty of responsible gun owners who just like to hunt or just like to target shoot, whatever. I'm talking about, like, the ones who like really thought Obama was coming for their guns. I've heard people at my old workplace, because I used to live in a very rural, very gun owner area built around a Remington Arms factory, actually. You know, talk about like their anti-Obama, anti-apocalypse.
I remember. I'm down here in Texas. I remember talk of a couple of years back of the Jade Helm 15 exercises.
Oh, yes, of course.
And I was smack dab in the middle of that down here, and there were actually people who believed it was a front for, the collection of guns and brainwashing. Walmarts were shut down because, you know, they're being used for FEMA torture gardens or something, and... I had a running joke about that, as like that the classic rock station here plays Hotel California like 8 times a day, and I used to joke around that was actually a signal that there's no escape from Jade Helm 15.
The Big Lebowski taught us all the danger of the Eagles, so. Yeah, no, I'm actually surprised that it might just be that we don't have like a thriving like B movie circuit much anymore, except horror films are actually increasingly money makers now, even independently. But yeah, we don't have like that thriving like Italian like scene where you could just make a ripoff action film and sell it to the like American VHS market. And, you know, make back your budget times, like, two or three, and then move on to the next film. Like, because, like, stuff like that would be great fodder for, like, modern B-movies.
Oh, yeah, and see, and that's why we celebrate that era, Joel, because, you know, they don't do, they don't make them like they used to. And, you know, they don't have video stores to cater to anymore. And so, you know, our job here is to really keep these movies alive. And, you know, talk them up as much as we can. And, you know, let people know that these movies are out there. And even if they're not very good, there's something in there that, you know, should arouse curiosity at the very least. And a lot of these films, these copycat films, are not necessarily very good. But at the same time, you know, there's just something about them that's entertaining. You know, you're trying to... Maybe you're trying to spot, you know, what they ripped off from what movie. And, you know, because there's a lot of crossover films in a lot of these movies, like Escape from New York mixed with The Warriors, mixed with Class of 1999, you know, whatever the case is, all in one movie. And so, you know, that's why we bring this service to our listeners, is, you know, to keep stuff like this out there, to keep it going.
Yeah, I think one of my favorite things, because obviously, like, Italian films in particular, also Australian and Filipino, a lot of different, like, foreign film scenes really hold a major place in the hearts of cult fans. And I think part of the fun of it, especially the Italian ones, is seeing how these other cultures interpret American culture and sell it back to us.
Yeah, I love that about the... I love that about Italian cinema.
Like, and, you know, then there are certain points at which it becomes its own sort of... They accidentally, just through accretion, through repetition of our tropes, skewing them into something else, create their own genre. I mean, the spaghetti Western is markedly different from like a normal Hollywood Western. And I almost think like the Italian post-apocalyptic film, especially Castellari's stuff, but I mean, you've got a million other ones. You've got like, you know, 2019 After the Fall of New York, and you've got Exterminators of the Year 3000. Like, they also create their own feel of the post-apocalyptic setting. Like, because even like weird stuff like Bruno Mattei's Rax, Night of Terror, which combined like mutated Rax with post-apocalyptic gangs, because there's a level like Mad Max, like Road Warrior, is awesomely striking in visual and it's a brilliant film, but it's fundamentally as enjoyable as it is, it's too good a film to be dumb fun. Like, it's absolutely compelling, but like when I think of like dumb fun for an afternoon, like Escape from the Bronx is a perfect goddamn movie.
That's absolutely correct. You know, the Road Warrior is actually cinematic royalty for the action genre, and you know, something like Escape from the Bronx like you said, it's just dumb fun. Hey, let's watch something stupid. We don't have to think much about it. Let's throw this movie in, and that's what that is.
Yeah, like, I mean, and, you know, like, I don't have to tell people to go out and watch The Warriors or Escape from New York or The Road Warrior. If you haven't seen it, you know about it. You know its reputation. And I think Escape from the Bronx obviously has a big cult around it. I think its influence is actually pretty outsized compared to where it came, where it came from and what its motivations as a film were. Like I said, I think it had a huge influence on Turbo Kid, on My Chemical Romance. I think there's something really compelling about wanting to be part of that basically consequence-free post-apocalyptic world. So it's definitely, if I had to recommend one of these films for people, I think this would be, people would be surprised at how much they love Escape from the Bronx.
Yeah, exactly. And I know I love it. And I think what I'm going to do, though, if I had to recommend a film, though, Joel, I'm going to go with something that's much more well-known, only because I love the movie and I love, you know, any opportunity to talk it up. And it has a futuristic setting, of course, and there's this military-industrial complex feel to it as well. But there's also corporate and also the power of television as well involved in this. And I would recommend The Running Man, the 1987 film with Arnold Schwarzenegger. It's another one of those movies. It is dumb fun, but at the same time, it's saying something. And the Running Man is one of Schwarzenegger's. I guess, you know, when you're talking 80s action films, when you're talking to Schwarzenegger's 80s library, you're talking The Terminator, you're talking Commando, you're talking Predator, and I really think The Running Man is deserving of being, you know, in that mix with you know, his top three films. It's just a good time from beginning to end, and just the fact that television rules the world in this setting. Everyone's watching the Running Man game show, and it has a huge influence on, you know, the criminal justice system as well in that setting. And I really like it, and I'm going to say that I like it better than Predator itself, really. Now, Predator is a good film, but I feel more strongly about The Running Man than I do Predator. And that would be my recommendation.
It's a great recommendation. That's another strand we... God, didn't even get a chance to talk about the sort of post-apocalyptic entertainment strand, like the game show, like gladiatorial strand of it, where, I mean, you know, of course, leading into Battle Royale, to the Hunger Games, I mean, it's still with us. This idea is still with us and still very pervasive, which I find interesting. Maybe even more so than the Escape from New York and Mad Max, although obviously we did recently have a very successful Mad Max sequel. But this premise, I mean, you could harken back to The Most Dangerous Game. I mean, the idea of hunting humans is sort of a classic sort of subversive genre premise. I think there was a short story, The Seventh Victim, which is sort of a predating and like precursor to the Running Man, and got made into a film in the 60s called The Tenth Victim.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, three more victims, I guess. Okay. So the idea is a recurring one. I mean, you could even go back to, of course, gladiatorial games in ancient Rome. I think in Western culture, when we think a society collapsing, we always think the fall of Rome.
Yeah.
But you could go back to, I don't know, like all the labyrinth legends in Greek mythology. I mean, the idea of life being your survival being treated as a game is a really pervasive one, and I think that ties in well with like Bronx Warriors and Escape from the Bronx, because those feel like a big game you're playing, but it's one where you kind of set the rules. Running Man, Battle Royale, Hunger Games work because you don't have that opportunity. Like Escape from New York, you're just being put into this without any like choice of your own.
Exactly, yeah, that's a great tie-in there. Absolutely, I agree with that. Well, I think we've run the gamut of discussion on this topic. It was a very good discussion. I think we hit on a lot of stuff that we hadn't discussed, you know, pre-show. So there were definitely some surprises in here as far as a discussion standpoint. The influence of Mad Max and Escape from New York is still, you know, being felt in this current setting, and for good reason. These are archetypal films in the action sci-fi genre, and some very good ones at that. So I guess we'll wrap it up for the week. Joel, thank you for your input as always. I do appreciate it.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you for yours, man.
And until next time, you remember your mom-and-pop video store, because it is the cornerstone of all your nostalgia. It is mine, that's for sure. Thank you for joining us. We'll see you next week.